Good afternoon.
Herzlich willkommen.
Good afternoon. Welcome to another, dare I say, colloquium of the Institute. I'm very happy to introduce, if it needs to do, introduce Gretchen Bakker to you. She probably doesn't need introducing because many of you have probably come across her in various teaching formats. She's a visiting professor at our institute, so the Institute of European Technology, but based at the IRE Thesis, the Integrated Research Institute Transformations of Human Environment Systems. Very happy to have you here. In some ways, it's your sort of your inaugural presentation, if you like. You haven't talked to the institute as a whole or in that sort of size. So I'm very glad to have you here. Gretchen is an anthropologist who received a PhD in 2007 from the University of Chicago with a piece, a dissertation on contemporary Slovene art and artifice. I think we're going back today to Slovenia, as you can see from the title. So there's one strand of her work around an anthropology of arts, which is not so much a kind of media anthropology, but more on the anthropology of the social context, the means of production, and the wider issues surrounding art and art production. So that's one area of her work. And some of you, probably mostly people related to karma and that kind of work, will know her textbook or her course text on the anthropology of the arts, a sort of widely read reader introducing students and others to this perspective. The other line of work, which we originally thought would have this political dimension for the talk today, but as it turns out, it doesn't. which is good, but it hasn't. Is a very popular book, a book entitled The Grid, which is a historical ethnographic analysis of the development of North American, or US American, I should say, the electricity grid, and how that links up with, I guess, American ways of life, a detailed historical analysis. And may I a brag about it, so to speak, that I think it was Bill Gates who listed it as a top five reads of the year 2016. So if you're interested in something that is seeming as boring as infrastructure, the electricity grid, and you want to be fascinated by it, I do recommend this book to you. That obviously has a very, very strong political dimension, although it's probably more implicit than we have heard in many of the talks here. But today's talk is going in a different direction of politics and personhood. Maybe just a couple of words about you as a maybe anthropologist, scientist, whatever, academic. Gretchen writes a lot and writes a lot in very different media and formats. So a very, very prolific writer, and also a very prolific commentator. And one of the things we've come to appreciate, apart from your own work at the IRE Thesis, that she's brilliant at reading others' texts and presentations, sort of thinking her way into it and making extremely clever and sort of pointing comments on this. So if anyone here is interested in critical feedback on whatever you're doing, you're having a, I'm not saying individually call it up and get help, that's not what I meant.
Just bring up your papers and then.
I meant if you're sort of in the area of infrastructure work or the arts, etc., if you're in a reading group or whatever. I find this an extremely valuable, very good with language and with structuring arguments, extremely helpful in that direction, apart from her own work, which you may or may not be interested in. I've also been told that some viewer or rather listener discretion is advised for today's talk, as there will be strong language, so don't be offended. or be offended, whatever, but enjoy anyway. So it's all over to you, politics and personal considerations from Slovenia. The floor is all yours. Glad that you can make it, make it. Thank you.
So the grid. No, I'm not going to talk about the grid, but the reason that I'm not actually talking about that is that I do a lot of legislative history in that book, and it's really hard to be interested in. So I thought I would spare you, 1970s, how a bill becomes a law stories about the U.S. So instead, I want to say thank you. Thank you to the Institute for having me. I'm here for 3 years. I'm super happy to be here. So thanks for inviting me today. Thanks for allowing me to be in Berlin, to be a part of this community. And I didn't want to say it, but I looked at the weather today, and it's minus 28 degrees in Montreal. So I'm also really happy to just be able to go outside. So this sort of this winter joy. It's getting dark, but still, I'm very happy to be here. So before I wrote the grid book took a decade. I was working in Slovenia, and in my dissertation, I came across a problem I didn't know how to solve. I wasn't smart enough to solve it, essentially. And I decided I would write a chapter of a book every year towards that, and then I got distracted by the grid book, and then that took forever. And so, essentially, this project is about 15 years old at this point. And I have, in the first 3 or 4 months that I was here, I wrote the last 2 chapters of it. So I had quite a bit of it done. Now it's under contract, it'll come out next year. And the book is called The Likeness, Semblance and Self in Slovene Society. So, like many people, including Elizabeth Dunn, who we've seen, who work in the former communist world, I'm really interested in how personhood and subjectivity are made, whether intentionally or accidentally, and how practices and modes of self-understanding are remade as socio-political contexts change. Many anthropologists have considered these issues in relationship to religious conversions, and I'll talk about that a tiny bit today, most especially conversions to Protestantism. And my interest is actually in what I think of as capitalist conversions, or how people are remade when economic systems, which are of course always ideological systems, sort of work to refigure them as persons. So in Slovenia, the kind of version of this is an intense and abiding resistance to the depth model of subjectivity. And this paper is one chapter of that. So it's this kind of pushing away lots of different ways. I don't have one brilliant solution like this is like, Slovene subjectivity is like this. In effect, subjectivity is always diverse, right? Nevertheless, there are many examples of different ways in which people pushed away the idea of an inner self being where true essential identity happened. So this model of an inner true self, which is not accessible, and then a kind of surface, which is supposed to reflect that true self, right? This is a very particular subjective practice. And so to do that, I look at art projects and artists, I look at philosophical work and philosophers. Today is Philosopher Day. And I look at grammar, and I look at Melania Trump in the afterword, the Slovene wife to the American president, as you know, who is constantly and publicly critiqued for the ways that she's doing her subjectivity wrong. So this is drawn from chapter 4. It's a short version of chapter 4 of the book. That chapter is called Is Slavoj Žižek Full of Shit? And I actually took out of a lot of swearing. There's way more swearing in the chapter, but there'll still be a lot. Okay. So hopefully that will be okay. I just brought you this. You are European, but if you're not, people never have any idea where this place is. So it's the northernmost republic of former Yugoslavia and the southernmost area of what was the Austrian Empire. So it has this quite alpine, tiny little coastline. I'm happy to talk, I'm not going to talk about Slovenia, but in the question and answers, if you have demographic, historical, linguistic questions, you can actually ask.
I can
talk about it. So I'm going to start with a little movie of Žižek. This one is, so he's given this particular story that he's going to tell in this movie. He's done it many, many, many times. This one is in Slovene, which is why I kind of like it. It's quite old. So as you will see.
Če primerjamo francoska, nemška in angloameriška stranišča, imamo
Semiotični trikotniki je natančno korelativen Levi-Strossovemu, tako rekoč ekskrementalni protipol hrani. Se pravi, imamo, kot vsi vemo, nemška stranišča so tako zgrajena, vsaj tradicionalna, da je ravna plošča, potem je pa čisto sprednji luk na kamor vodi iztrebek izgine. Ideja je o tem, da ko izločite iztrebek, je iztrebek tako rekoč izpostavljen vašemu pogledu, to so tudi nemški rituali, da treba vohati, gledati ali imaš tiste in tako naprej. Francosko stranište, kot bo vsak povedal, je pa nasprotno. Luknja je večja in zade, tako da iztrebek direktno pade v vodo, da zgine čim prej. Ameriški je pa neke vrste korelat kuhanega po Levi-Strossu, je to kombinacija. Se pravi, iztrebek ostane, ne izgine, ampak plava v vodi. In potem sem si prav pogledal par knjig o tej zadevah. In prišel do rezultata, da vsaka nacionalnost skuša utemeljiti svojo varianto kot najbolj razvidno, kot najbolj samoumevno. Ampak evidentno je, da je nek cel zapleten semiotični sistem tukaj na delu. In če ne gre...
Ok. So part one. Is Slavoj Žižek full of shit? It is not unusual to hear it said that Žižek is full of shit. For example, I like Žižek. He might be full of shit 99% of the time, but it's very entertaining shit. Or, I don't want to assert that the rock star of cultural theory is full of shit, but you know, Slavoj Žižek seems to me to be kind of full of shit. Or this, in a more academic vein, even though the sentiment is certainly the same. Žižek is a big fake, but one that typifies today's celebrated, read celebrity, scholar. This is from Savage Minds, the anthropology blog. And it goes on, and on it goes. It's just all posturing verbiage. He's pretty charismatic and pretty nonsensical. The language is needlessly complex. Žižek's article can be described as, quote, random thoughts about a few movies with a bit of psychoanalysis thrown in. I'm sure many people have seen, this is another quote, I'm sure many people have seen the philosopher's tendency to abusively use scientific lingo to make their writing sound more profound. Some philosophers do this more than others, and I think Žižek is a prime example of it. Or this on-again, off-again appearance on Wikipedia. And does it appears and disappears. Harpam calls Žižek's style a stream of non-consecutive units arranged in arbitrary sequence that solicit a sporadic and discontinuous attention. O'Neill concurs, a dizzying array of wildly entertaining and often quite maddening rhetorical strategies are deployed in order to beguile, browbeat, dumbfound, dazzle, confuse, mislead, overwhelm, and generally subdue the reader into acceptance. Similarly, when Noam Chomsky makes his feelings about Žižek known, this was a big brouhaha in 2016, it is titled, Noam Chomsky Thinks Slavoj Žižek is Full of Shit, though the former never says as much. He does delineate the problem. I'm not interested, this is Chomsky, I'm not interested in posturing, using fancy terms like polysyllables and pretending that you have a theory when you have no theory whatsoever. So there's no theory in any of this stuff. Try to find empirically testable propositions where it all goes beyond the level of something you can explain in 5 minutes to a 12-year-old. See if you can find that when the fancy words are decoded. I can't. So I'm not interested in that kind of posturing. Žižek is an extreme example of it. I don't see anything to what he is saying. From there, Chomsky pulls a classic move of one-upmanship. Jacques Lacan I actually knew. I kind of liked him. We had a meeting every once in a while. But frankly, I thought he was a total charlatan. And on the critiques of Žižek go in this vein. On and on. Formally, taken en masse, what the above quotations intimate is that there is something not quite right, not quite believable to a certain kind of audience in what, or rather how, Žižek writes, speaks, or generally plies his trade as a philosopher. As I have argued elsewhere, the easy nomination of Žižek's full of shitness subtends to the very artful way in which he balances between a real, serious instantiation of a philosopher and equally a sort of spoof of that thing, a philosopher. The balancing act, not the judgment rendered, being what is interesting. And though Žižek offers readers ample opportunity to read him according to a single valence, one might even say he tempts his readers and other audiences to easy judgment. Charlatan, fake, celebrity scholar, nonsensical, non-serious, etc. Equally, he's a bit too smart and a little bit too well-read to disregard as not philosophical at all. Hence the problem for the serious critic. One can pull him into his role, philosopher, but it is constantly, irritatingly impossible. He himself makes it impossible to do this with any sense of purity. The non-philosopher, the man at play, is always also there, a counterpunctual beat that strikes at nearly the same moment as the main rhythm to jangle the nerves. Two, evidence of a different sort. Once, years ago, I saw Žižek give a talk at some sort of scholarly conference, a big room filled with fans and tourists drawn to a name of repute. Before us, the room had set stage to Cornel West, who will come back in this talk. He is also a celebrity philosopher, and he was also doing his thing. It was that kind of conference. Unlike West, when Žižek's time was up, he just kept talking. Has anyone here seen him speak? Yeah, so he does this, right? This was not one time. He stayed at the podium, he kept taking questions. After a while, the cautious waving of the timekeeper became more and more exaggerated, right? Until she came out upon the stage and said to him, still with a polite bow of deference of the bureaucrat reserves for the star, that it was time to go. Yes, yes, he said into the microphone, in 1 minute, and then he continued to talk. 1 minute double to two quintuple to 10, and the timekeeper was out again. You really must go. And yes, yes, he said, and he took another question. The room was now doubly full as the people there to see the next speaker had come in. They'd leaked out into the aisles. They'd filled up every spare cranny there barely was before. Now nobody could get out if they wanted. It was like a nightclub fire waiting for the spark of ignition. The organizers began to mass at the side of the stage. You could see them wishing that they had that hook on a very long stick that belonged to the early days of vaudeville, when one could reach out onto the stage, right, and grab a performer by the waist and physically pull him off the stage into the wings. But this is Žižek, the celebrity philosopher. One could no more yank him from his podium than one could Cornel West. These men, they brook no interruption. The room grows fuller, the minutes pass, the questions keep coming. Žižek talks and he wipes his brow and he plucks his shirt, he touches his nose and his hair, and his accent is thick and lisped and foreign. In the end, for it does end, a man comes out and he takes the microphone, he twists it away from Žižek and toward his own mouth, and he says, this session is done. The audience had been a part of something, inside something that was not conference and also not nightclub. It didn't smell of philosophy, it smelled of man. The man is soaked with sweat and he doesn't care. The crowd surges forward, too many of them moving toward him rather than away, toward the doors and the hallway, and the next thing bound to be of a different order than this one. The organizers now have a new problem. Some minor portion of the audience, but still too large, has become a nimbus floating six deep around Žižek, who the timekeepers have finally gotten off the stage and onto the robustly carpeted floor. I am there too in the turbulent bubble. I have something to say about a book I might one day write about Slovenia. I want to warn him that it's coming. But before I get the chance, he looks at me in the eye and tells a dirty joke. He points to his pants dick, to our chests, and he laughs, and all around him, we laugh too. At the punchline. It makes me feel at home, like a blister of Slovenia has come to rest here in this awkward conference venue. There, here, I'm always pushed off guard so much so that there is no balance, only off balance and wildly insufficient sea legs. It's a hominess of vertigo, of falling down, of constant resplendent failure. I laugh because it's funny, not the joke necessarily, though it might have been, but the whole remarkable genius horror thing. The nimbus slowly rotates as the men and women in charge, they've called in reinforcements now, there are rather a lot of them, push the whole constellation toward the doors. But it's a big room and the doors are far away. It takes another 20 minutes to disgorge the speaking thing and its aureola out into the hallway. It's been 3 hours since Žižek took the stage. and those devoted to the smooth functioning and conferences in their center will likely remember him forever as the worst speaker in conference center history. What a piece of shit. It was performance art, no less nor more than anything else. Žižek doing Žižek, part of what Žižek does best. It is perhaps in his nature, whatever that means. There are other things I remember. I remember how he showed a filmmaker in a documentary she was making about him that he keeps his clothes folded neatly in the kitchen cabinets. I've had friends like this, but none of them are famous. Nobody is putting their questionable sock drawer on camera. And this difference between doing or being someone deeply quirky and showing that you are such a someone is more important than it might seem, because there is something wrong about how Žižek does Žižek. This wrongness, the fact that it seems to be in his nature, and the ease with which he is called full of shit, I think, are linked. The man is irritating, and the irritant is specific. Slavoj Žižek always feels more like a show than like a person. He feels this way live, he feels this way on film, he feels this way on the typeset page. It is as if he cannot simply be Žižek, but must always perform Žižek. As if he himself were a role, not a person, albeit a role that gives every impression of endlessly delighting its performer. So assiduous is Žižek in this performance, so unwavering, that it becomes impossible to imagine a moment of repose when he stops playing at Žižek and is simply himself. Perhaps one is given to wonder, is the show all there is? Perhaps there is no self under there for him to be. Perhaps it's just surface, bluster, and then nothing at all. In this way, one might argue that Žižek is dreamily resplendent, complicated and confusing shell, a super adequate husk, the carapace of a man scrawled with the word philosopher. And if he is all surface, all performance, if there is no there in there, it is easy to imagine that the trouble with Žižek for folks more used to a determinate, trustworthy innerness might come from the question, what is he full of? What is inside the body when the normal, soulful, or authentic self is recognized to be missing? A question to which those comfortable with surface depth model of subjectivity and with expectations concerning its performance might easily answer shit. After all, everyone is full of something. My proposition, thus, is to take Žižek's being full of shit literally. For it is not only his critics who imagine him thusly. Žižek is also wont to treat inner being, the essence of oneself, as a dark, elemental, excremental mass. Quoting Hegel, for example, he writes that, quote, inner being is, in the first instance, still simple darkness, the unmoved, the black, formless stone. And just in case the analogy is too subtle, he continues, the anal association here is fully justified. The immediate appearance of the inner is formless shit. Two important aspects of shit are here highlighted in the least metaphoric of ways. First, it is substantive. Shit is a mass, a material, a thing in its own right. Second, it is formless, which is to say that it is not easily wrought or crafted. He has left out the stinky factor, but we will come back to that. Three. A turn toward bullshit and politics. Speaking of bullshit, philosopher Harry Frankfurt, I have Franklin everywhere else, I'm going to say Franklin. Philosopher Harry Franklin makes this point of the shit's resistance to artistry rather plainly. Is the bullshitter, so he has this little book is called On Bullshit, and it's a philosophical treatise on bullshit. And there's another one that just came out that's also called Of Assholes, and it's also a philosophical treatise. So this is something that's happening in philosophy right now. Is the bullshitter, by his nature, a mindless slob? Is his product necessarily messy or unrefined? The word shit does, to be sure, suggest this. Excrement is not designed or crafted at all. It is merely emitted or dumped. It may have a more or less coherent shape, or it may not. But in any case, it is certainly not rocked. There is, in other words, no artisanal asshole. Everyone may make shit, but no one makes it nicely. And bullshitters, it seems, make bullshit with the same disregard for the artistry of the stuff as shitters who make shit. Franklin, who sees bullshit as among the most salient features of our times, bemoans our lack of a theory of it. We lack, he says, a conscientiously developed appreciation of what it means to us. We have no clear understanding of what bullshit is, why there is so much of it, or what functions it serves. And though Franklin puts most of his analytic interest on the bull part of this compound word, leaving aside the shit, which as a substance does seem to repulse analytic attention, Franklin nevertheless provides us with a way into understanding just what exactly the complaint is against Žižek. Žižek doesn't take enough care, by his critics' measure, of the crap he spews. Rather than crafting an argument that we can take literally, or take metaphorically, or take for its inspiration and insight, we are left with, quote, a stream of non-consecutive units arranged in arbitrary sequences from the beginning. What could this describe, really, except shit? Franklin's argument regarding bullshit and bullshitters matters here, not simply because he is bold enough to take this particular bull by its horns, nor because it does appear to describe what Žižek is doing, but because at its heart it assumes a particular formation of the subject, one premised upon a difference between what is hidden from public view inside the bullshitter's mind and the self-aggrandizing, often buffoonable self made publicly available through word and deed. And though Franklin takes care to differentiate between the bullshitter and the liar as distinct types, there is nevertheless a genealogy of mind he considers worth tracing out. Whenever a person deliberately misrepresents anything, he must inevitably be misrepresenting his own state of mind. Thus, someone who lies about how much money he has in his pocket both gives an account of the amount of money in his pocket and conveys that he believes this account. If the lie works, then his victim is twice deceived, having one false belief about what is in the liar's pocket and another false belief about what is in the liar's mind. Truth, regarding the amount of money in a pocket, for example, is not what the liar principally hopes to distort. Rather, his aim is to convince others that the state of his mind is other than what it is. His aim is a misrepresentation of an inner fact, a fact that cannot be known but through its earnest expression. The liar, in his performance of subjectivity, is thus not so different from someone who is utterly sincere. According to anthropologist Webb Keane, sincerity is, quote, a way of characterizing a relationship between words and interior states. To be sincere is to utter words that can be taken primarily to express underlying beliefs or intentions. As such, sincerity makes the interior state transparent. In sharp contrast to lies and to bullshit, sincere speech aims to convincingly and truthfully represent innerness. Sincerity, Keane continues, adds and subtracts nothing in words that was not already there in thought. And it effects this sense of transparency to an audience primed to understand this mode of communication and its implications. That is to say, both the speaker and those with whom he or she is speaking understand themselves to have inner selves and share the presumption that these can be known and earnestly, honestly, and purely communicated. Or they can be dishonestly communicated. The liar has the same sort of self-constitution. He just uses it to different ends. In contrast, the bullshitter is interested in neither the truth nor the lies. What he is principally interested in, according to Franklin, is himself. And Franklin says that bullshitters can be men and women, but he only talks about men. There's one woman and one footnote in the whole book. So it's this sort of himself is actually from Franklin's work. We could talk about that too. For Franklin, the facts of the matter, or for the bullshitter, the facts of the matter become aesthetic accoutrement to a different project, the aggrandizement of self. And here's a long quotation from Franklin by way of example, and this is where we get to the politician. Consider a 4th of July orator who goes on bombastically about our great and blessed country, whose founding fathers under, this is from the US context, obviously, whose founding fathers under divine guidance created a new beginning for mankind. This is surely bullshit. The orator is not lying. He would be lying only if it were his intention to bring about in his audience beliefs that he himself regards as false. concerning matters as whether our country is great, whether it is blessed, whether the founding fathers had divine guidance, and whether what they did was an act to create a new beginning for mankind. But the orator does not really care what his audience thinks about the founding fathers or the role of the deity in our country or the like. It is clear that what makes the 4th of July oration bullshit is not fundamentally that the speaker regards his statements as false. Rather, it is that the orator intends these statements to convey a certain impression of himself. He is not trying to deceive anyone concerning American history. What he cares about is what people think of him. In other words, the bullshitter is a different sort of person. Instead of truth, of self, or anything else, the bullshitter principally cares for the nuances of self-aggrandizing performance. He reads his audiences and plays them to make himself from their jeers or cheers, as the case may be. More than just courting likes, to use Facebook terminology for a common approach to crowd appeal, the bullshitter, according to Franklin, is both literally and figuratively full of shit. A fact that he does not hide, but rather flaunts, as shit is dumped from his mouth. And rather than flushing it away, the bullshitter holds it to himself, and calls it me. This is not craft work, but impression by accumulation or coalescence. The bullshitter is a common grotesque. In America, at least, we make presidents of them. It is easy enough, I think, to read Žižek through Franklin and see relatively little difference between the bullshitter with his perverse self-constitution and the Slovene philosopher who also seems to play the part of himself like some happy vaudevillian at long last granted his moment upon the stage. What matters, however, about Franklin's typology and the judgments renderable from it is that he is principally describing a normative field, not a man. There is a proper way to do subjectivity, he suggests, which the bullshitter ignores, to the detriment not of himself so much as the larger community. It may well be that rather than manifesting an interest in truth, rather than caring about sincerity, rather even than lying, which at least recognizes the truth, if only to diverge intentionally from it, the bullshitter uses his subjectivity to wrong effect. His innerness seems empty, and his words and deeds just for show. He feels wrong. And here Franklin quotes another Slovene philosopher, Mladen Dolar. His words are, quote, hot air, mere vapor. His speech empty, without substance or content. His use of language, accordingly, does not contribute to the purpose it purports to serve. However true this may be, what is interesting is the capacity to pass judgment. To know a form of subjectivity is wrong and to call it by a name, full of shit or bullshit or, dare I say it, Trump shit. In other words, a normative field has been articulated, if between the lines. From Franklin's careful delineation of the bullshitter, it is possible to backform his version of the proper subject. The language of a right man should not be, quote, needlessly complex. All these quotes are from the critiques of Žižek at the start. It should not ring as posturing verbiage. It should not principally be charismatic, especially when this charisma is built upon nonsensical grounds. Language should be contentful, informative, transparent, and ideally honest. This is what I'm doing, right? I'm doing this thing, this normative thing. As such, language is asked to carry something nutritive, a sort of innerness of orator that can be known and ideally trusted. It should function as a gift of the self, that old idea that the speaker invests himself in his utterances, granting at the very least the knowledge of his own constitution to his audience. Such a subject knows and cares to know who he really is. He may lie, but at least in the pure act of lying, he gives evidence of an inner self that recognizes the difference between right and wrong. Not to poke too many pointed sticks in the body of the bullshitter, he is too easy a pincushion for those concerned with the rampant rise of fake news and alternative facts, but one feels in Franklin's work a sense of moral affront. It is not just that the bullshitter is bullshitting us that marks him as offensive, it's that he does his selfhood wrong. For Franklin, ignoring the garden of the inner, leaving its secrets and psychologies unplumbed and untended, means sidestepping an intimate, long-standing procedure of self-formation, what Keith Hawkins has called the self-examining self. Far from the natural feel one gets from Franklin, the self-examining self is historically and culturally particular, having arisen in the late 1700s in Europe to become the normative mode of modern subjectivity. To twist toward hegemony for a moment, it is not that one can know oneself, it's that one must. How does such self-knowledge, how one does such self-knowledge the right way is as simple as it is ubiquitous. Anyone who's read Foucault knows what's coming next. As much a social procedure as an intimate one, one knows oneself the same way that one knows anything. One conducts an examination. Or, as Adam Smith explained in 1749, when I endeavor to examine my own conduct, it is evident that in all such cases, I divide myself, as it were, into two persons, and that I, the examiner and judge, represent a different character from the other I, the person whose conduct is examined into and judged of. In effect, this splitting of the self into examiner and judge and examinee judged of internalized procedures of examination, marking, ranking, and placement within a statistical field that was becoming ubiquitous in late 18th century Europe. I'm not going to talk about this very long. I could, but I won't. What was happening institutionally in the governing of society was also happening internally in the governing of selves. Hoskins identifies this process as having begun with a strange project of examining students by having them sit in a chair and write about what they know. Quote, prisons, schools, hospitals, factories, universities, state bureaucracies, and corporate oligopolies most resemble each other as both social worlds and the self become more and more subject to a writing, grading, and examining, which together ensure the meticulous and continual circulation of plans, examinations, reports, feedback, and feed-forward evaluations, knowing me, knowing you, in our respective truths. A long half-century later, in the mid-1800s, there was a second shift, whereby self-examination, conducted to produce self-knowledge, became an initial step toward self-improvement. With legible irritability, E. Bulwer Lytton Caxton III wrote in 1849, "Know thyself," said the old philosophy. "Improve thyself," saith the new. In other words, examination as a mode of ascertaining or bringing into the light something hidden, knowledge or deviant kernel or complex institutional process, gave way to a notion of betterment, improvement of people, systems, and selves, or what Hoskins calls feed-forward effects, became the explicit point of examination. In this way, what began as a mode of measurement within a standardized field, that is, what is, slipped explicitly over into marking a goal or target, or what ought to be. It is this confusion of is with ought that Hoskins, following Hume, claims constitutes the modern self, every bit as much as it constitutes modern bureaucracy. One doesn't examine or audit systems or persons to gain static knowledge about them. Rather, one conducts such examinations to determine how and in what domain improvement might be best made. Or to quote Cornel West, who says it best,
life is not worth living, Plato says in 938A of the Apology. How do you examine yourself? What happens when you interrogate yourself? What happens when you begin to call into question your tacit assumptions and unarticulated presuppositions and begin then to become a different kind of person?
Right. So here's the quote that he says. He continues, and the reason I can't play it is because he says a lot of other stuff in between. He continues, speaking of himself, "I am a blues man in the life of the mind. I am a jazz man in the world of ideas." This improvisational flexibility of a self, so well known that it can be shifted and altered, adds another layer to E. Bulwer Lytton Caxton III's right man, who self-examines toward self-improvement. Cornel West's internal jazz man and blues man already know so much. They are masters of their genre. They can shift and groove selfhood adaptively. If self-examination leads to change, self-jazzification takes us to next-level interiority, as the self itself is played, the true eye a constant and demanding work of skilled improvisation. The self-made man, whether known, improved, or played, proceeds in each case from an inner transformation toward outer expressivity or competence. To this we might add what we know from Hoskins, that this imperative as a normative feature of social life is the result of culturally specific developments in Northern Europe in the late 1700s that spread with a factory, prison, and systems of statecraft through the long 19th century. The management of organizations and the management of individuals proceeded hand in glove as Europe changed and colonized much of the world. And we know from Franklin that it is that to not engage in this subjective mode, to not follow the Delphic imperative, to know thyself, feels like a form of perversion. From the internet, but also from Franklin, we come to understand that shit is the right moniker for a man who cares not for tending his innerness, but only for the flagrant performance and self-aggrandizement of the outer. The bullshitter is thus something of a rebel, characterized not by his amorphous, uncrafted, and uncultivated innerness, but by his lack of self-examination. It is not just that he is full of shit, it's that he is shamelessly and obviously full of it. Nothing is hidden. Further examination yields nothing of surprise. Nothing more needs to be known beyond what is given. And there is thus no room for self-improvement. The very material of the self is wrong in its resistance, not so much to being known, but to being finely crafted. I suspect that, for those who believe in the Delphic imperative, proper self-constitution is rallied against so strongly because of a fear, not of the bullshitter, per se, but of all those regular people who are enraptured when presented with an empty, bullshitty performance. It would seem that some measure of the crowd, the mass, the electorate, the kids these days, and on, like the bullshit, and eschew the self-examining, self-constituting, self-clairvoyant, and self-understanding self as a normative imposition, which is precisely what it is. West and Franklin's right way of doing subjectivity should feel vaguely creepy and ideological, even if you are one of those people for whom it also feels mostly exactly right. For as the necessity to proselytize, even browbeat for a self-examining self, demonstrates other modes of subjectivity are already everywhere in evidence. There would, in other words, be no need to warn against the charms of the man full of shit if that mode of self did not have significant appeal. The worry is not that Zizek is a bad philosopher, but that people might take him seriously. The worry is that people like those at Franklin's fictional 4th of July picnic in the long quotation before might well vote for the bullshitter. And for his part, Zizek could only have earned the moniker celebrity scholar because some people adore him. I adore him.
Still?
I do. He does do subjectivity wrong if you're looking for evidence of self-examination, self-clairvoyance, and self-care. As such, full of shit is a fair critique. But in all of his blather and buffoonery, he does something else very right. He makes the normative social field, which structures every argument against him, explicit. One technique is to take the shit inside of him, inside of us all, and incorporate it into his philosophical apparatus. A second is to write about it, and a third is to perform it. Zizek may not give a damn about the depth model of the self, split into examiner and examinee, with self-knowledge all mixed in with self-improvement, but he cares a great deal about the constitutive power of the immediate environment. He is always making the normative social field evident, collapsing the figure and the ground so that the figure, in Zizek's case always himself, is very shiny, but the ground is equally intrusive. The timekeeper at the conference, invisible in every other presentation, is forced to take center stage, to take the microphone and make the entire normative temporal order explicit. Time here is not some natural element of modern life, but rather made and enforced, agreed upon and shatterable. It is not the self that needs knowing, it's the normative social field that produces the sensation that the self needs knowing is what matters. To this end, the minions of time's regimented order were given life, embodied, made visible, and brought into play. Even audience members participated. We looked at our watches and our phones, and we whispered among ourselves about the time and the man who seemed not to care about it. We became witnesses and examiners of social structure as the ought was made explicit in its distinction from the is. One can say the same for the shape of the conference room with its retractable walls and grand doors only at the back. Venues like that one are made to be neutral, flexible spaces, places devoid of personality by design, colored all in beige as a mode of signaled neutrality. Yet as that ballroom filled up, it slid toward nightclub or tent revival. The dimensions of the space became evident as one wondered, I wondered, how to get out of there with so many people blocking the aisle. The specter of fire, the trampling rush of bodies hurtling toward too few ill-placed doors. And then the same space shifted in the absurd effort to get the speaking Zizek off the podium and out of there. A room for a man such as that would have to be designed differently if one's aim was to keep the spatial and temporal orders out of public view. Even as I work on this paper, I wonder if I can use the word shit so liberally in an academic presentation. And what of all the fucks and dams and assholes that follow in its wake? Is it okay to post that portrait of Zizek with its obvious vagina? The ground, which is to say, the larger context of capitalism and the contemporary university and of moral norms all come to life around Zizek. He, as the figure, calls the ground into evidence. He is always directing one's attention to himself and to something outside of himself, which constitutes the field of operations. Nor is this an accidental side effect of hubris. He does this on purpose. Last section, which is fairly short. In a 2008 film called, non-ironically, Examined Life, which we saw a little piece of, filmmaker Astra Taylor interviews 8 so-called celebrity philosophers as they wander around, in most cases, New York City. But in Zizek's case, the dump. The dump is loud, it stinks. Rats scurry through piles of trash, and Zizek basks in it. His nose never wrinkles, he barely stops talking when dump trucks and bulldozers heave and tumble piles of trash around them. This is where he wants to be. This is where he wants all of us to be, not flushing our shit down toilets and imagining it is gone, not tossing our water bottles in the trash and imagining the seas are not full of them, not living our perfumed lives unconscious in the fetidness of dumps. When we are standing where I'm standing now, he says, with a lot of trash behind me, this is where we should start feeling at home. I think in our daily attitude, not only with trash like this, but with more literal trash, like excrement, in our daily perception. The reality is that this disappears from our world. When you go to the toilet, shit disappears. You flush it, and while, of course, rationally, you know that it's there in canalization, at a certain level of your most elementary experience, it disappears from your world. The same happens with trash, but the problem is that trash doesn't disappear. Just as time doesn't disappear, shit doesn't disappear, just as vaginas and penises don't disappear, and capitalism doesn't disappear. We have designed spaces, systems, regimes, like toilets, swallow-up contents and remnants. With Zizek, though, these spaces, systems, and regimes are brought back. He thinks about the sewers that whisk our shit away, and he points to them, with words, with an index finger, with a story, and they come back to us for an instant. Why should an ecologist love trash? I would like to turn around the perspective. I think that what is truly threatening is not trash as such, it's separating trash. It's throwing trash out. I think that the ultimate horror is, again, a nice green pasture, or wherever trash disappears. I think that an ideally balanced ecological society would have to be a totally chaotic space where trash is simply a part of our environs and not discriminated against. So yes, Zizek is a bullshitter, but that doesn't mean he's not entirely in earnest. Embracing the bullshit, living with it, using it as an ethical mode is how he constitutes himself via the world, via not plumbing the depths, but through an aggressive relationship to what is exterior. I am not an inside, he seems to say. All of this is me too, though you might prefer it flushed away. It's there, here, all around. Under your pants is a vagina. In this conference is a temporal regime. In this room is a structured space of movement. In that toilet is a cultural ideology of the good relationship to shit. The ground is always present, even more so because there doesn't seem to be any true thing inside of Žižek at all. He's both very densely and uniquely himself, much as Cornel West is, and he is neither artful nor crafted. He is a sweaty, twitchy train wreck full of shit, and happily so. In this, Franklin and all Žižek's critics are right. Žižek makes himself, not by attending to inner truths or split self-examining, self-improving subjectivity, but rather by maintaining a distastefully intimate relationship with the world. He is of it, he makes himself of it, and then he forces this subjective blending as a sort of human environmental chimera upon the rest of us. His mode of being a subject is aggressive. He wants us, too, to live in a world not of the self, but of and with the intensity of context. And that is the end. I won't play it, but I do have him talking. I figured one Žižek talking is enough. So.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much, yeah. Gretchen. That's been a wicked presentation. I think a good example of how you can play with formats and work with language in ways that are probably not strictly academic if you have a narrow sense of of the academic genre. The floor is open to questions. It's probably not entirely easy to engage with it, but here we go.
Do we have a microphone, or should I just project the voice?
Yeah, project, please.
Okay. Ready?
Yes.
Now, this is a big, big question. That's why I'll just bear with me, okay?
Yeah.
So, I'm going to start with, when you said that we can see the bullshitter as a rebel. Someone who lacks self-examination, there is no room for self-improvement, although you also alluded to the worry and the problem that, what happens if people take him too seriously.
Right.
The question is going to be there. And I want to make a full disclosure, I'm with Cornel West and Know Thyself. Sorry.
Most people are.
Okay. I mean, there is also nuance there, but yeah. I assume I'm agree with that. So here's my beef with Žižek or with the presentation. As long as he remains in the realm of entertainment, or as long as he remains within Europe, I find this role performance very entertaining, and I grew up with him. I listened to his Ljubljana talks when I was in Ljubljana, before he was launched in the global fame. So I knew him at best, and I really liked him then, and I really read him and enjoyed him. But I have today, 15 years later, or 20 years later, I have a big problem with him because I see more detriment to others than positive, any positive effect. And actually, that makes him, in my eyes, wrong. And in your presentation you have described it very well, like how this kind of subjectivity actually has to be pointed out as wrong, and there is nothing else. So I think my worry is legitimate because I witnessed in my short academic life, once I started, being more in India or outside Europe, I witnessed him not only offending a whole lot of people, and offending is really understated here, because you can only cringe when you hear him speak about Dalits as, proletariat, because he has no understanding of caste. Within a caste, you can have a rich person and you can have a poor person, and he has he just maps class onto caste and gets away with it. And there are countless examples, like when he talks about an African-American poor mother woman as identity politics. Jesus Christ, I don't know if you watched that segment after he put out that book on air refugees after the summer, 2015. And Mehdi Hassan at Al Jazeera, he took him to task and really confronted him about, you're basically reifying stereotypes about Muslim men being the aggressors, even siding with gays, as you know, this is going to be now spoiling our progressive values in Europe. And, you know, you even redefined the whole Europe as Christian. Mm-hmm. And, you know, short saying, yeah, Christian, you know, Europe is white, or Europe is just for Europeans. So, I mean, I'm interested in, you know, when bullshit or shit becomes toxic. You know, what do you do with this toxicity? Because you haven't really, you know...
Right, but so I think that this is...
So this is in the realm of the political, you
right.
know, not Absolutely. Entertainment. Now we're talking politics, mm-hmm. and this has you know, real implications on the ground, wherever he goes. And I mean, especially in outside Europe, I find him absolutely repulsive. You know? So... And I'm very, very ashamed as a Slovenian who has, you know, psychoanalysis Lacanian DNA and has grown up with that. I feel so ashamed that the guy has no shame, that he has no knowledge about the non-Western canon, and he just runs his mouth like there is no tomorrow. I mean, he's really spewing shit, but it's toxic shit, you know? Okay, I'm done.
No, so this is really nice, because I think that you do a better job even than the quotes that I have of making this point that he does really give this feeling of being full of shit, right? Like, he is infuriating to people. And all of the points that you've touched on are things that Franklin has said, right? That there is no shame, that there's this giant performance, this kind of like excreting and padding and hoping to be taken in some way or another, whether by people making fun of him or thinking that he's great and deep, right? But being taken and believed and followed. Like, this is the point of the bullshitter. Mm-hmm. That the bullshitter doesn't care. The bullshitter doesn't care if they have class and caste wrong.
Yeah,
right?
Bush doesn't care.
Doesn't care.
I don't care about the
And
Bush
so in this, in yes, exactly. So in this way, I think what I like about the typology of the bullshitter is it does suit Žižek very nicely, right?
I
think that's true.
That. I'm worried
the
about that.
Yeah, the question then is the political ramifications of that. Yeah. So what you're saying is that a bullshitter should never... be allowed followers? Like, be allowed to be convincing?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that, I mean, I have a lot of friends who are Indians who are crazy about him, mm-hmm. and I have fights with them about it. But there is a certain, certain unconscious thing that he appeals to, which is troubling.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, let's talk about class consciousness, raising class consciousness. What about other consciousness?
Right.
I mean, this is the problem here, you know?
I have a nice quote from speaking of a lecture given by Žižek at the University of Vermont in 2016, an anonymous professor writes to me in an email, Žižek is certainly a spectacle both in the sense of enrapturing the audience and drawing them in, right? And this is the horror of the many the people in that room at that talk, right, who continued to the talk I was at, who continued to ask him questions for 3 hours. But also of the professor who sees his students being completely charmed, right? So there is a certain kind of person who is horrified by Žižek. And I think that's what I'm really pointing to, is that I can't say if he is good or bad. What I can say is that he pinpoints a performance of subjectivity which is infuriating to some people. Yeah. And it's that that he will not back down on that. He will do that.
Gretchen,
I agree
with you, and I think, you know, your presentation is really...
No, no, I'm not... And
I've never seen it. No, no, I've never seen it in this way, but really what I want to stress, which is actually my position and my point and my question is...
Right.
Yeah, okay, we can spend a lot of time understanding the bullshitter. And we are doing this with psychopaths, with fascists, with da-da-da-da-da. But the thing is that there has to be some, if it doesn't come from them, a certain responsibility, ethical, moral responsibility, to see that they are working with young minds or with younger people, because they have to have the responsibility. And this is what my beef is. There is no responsibility that this is the effect. It's basically manipulative, and it's basically, you know, leading. I'm not saying that these people are snowflakes, like in the US they tend to speak of young people, let's protect them all. No, but they are forming, and they usually absorb professors' unconsciousness. We all do.
So I just have to say this is exactly the same critique that people make of art and artists. That somehow the artist or the art has to be responsible to the reactions that people have to it. And I think there is something very, very strongly important about stirring things up.
I agree.
So I'm not saying that I think everything that Žižek says is right. I'm saying that he's doing something else, right? In addition to making comments, the way in which he is both performing philosopher and never performing philosopher, and that those two things are happening simultaneously, is doing something else. And the something else that is important to me here is actually that it's a critique. It's actually a critique of subjectivity.
I completely understand. So
that's the understand. Yeah. Does that make sense? Is that or does
that?
Yeah.
More questions.
Yeah.
Yes. I want to take you up on the political ramifications.
Good.
As well. But first of all, also, I really appreciate your kind of interpretation or reading of these reactions to Žižek in terms of the social, the sort of social panic or social fears, which of course also have to do with something sort of the death of the Enlightenment subject and all of our
Absolutely.
Current fears of sort of manipulability and enchantment and rapture, and as you say. And I think that these quotes and these reactions speak. I mean, I completely agree with you in how much they speak about this kind of social panic, which, of course, you know, is not just whatever limited to Žižek, but you know, it's a much more broader phenomenon. But still, I was just, I kind of still want to again go into the political ramifications, because of course there's something because there's something obviously that he makes visible, yeah,
right,
but. But for me, it's the question, like, how do we want to make things visible? And if we do that by kind of just, like, elbowing everybody around us and kind of trampling on people's things, that's just not a kind of politics. I mean, so really, it's like, what are the political implications of bullshitting if that entails just, like, basically screaming over everybody else? And, I mean, first of all, you take the stage, so you go to the conference and you take the stage, but then you don't submit to the terms of the conditions, that's just rude. And then, like, you know what I mean? So then say, okay, I want 3 hours an open-ended stage because I can't deal with this, you know, and I want the whole thing. But because it's just like, what kind of ethical relations does that entail with people who organize this, who, you know, you, like, Žižek doesn't have the work of organizing this conference, and he's just, you know, so this is what I'm asking. I mean, I understand that he might make things visible, but, like, there's a lot of violence, toxicity, around that, and so it's also about, you know, maybe the question of the personhood as a relational person, as a relational person,
yes,
and whether that gets evacuated.
I mean, I think that it's a good question and linked, right? That the question really is, who does he irritate?
Who
is irritated
everyone.
By him? No, everyone is not irritated by him. That's the point, right? Like, there's... He's not a polite person, right? He doesn't want to play that game. He doesn't want to go in and say, I'm going to take 3 hours at this conference. He's doing something else, right? And read as a kind of performance, it's extremely effective. So when I was in Slovenia, I spent a lot of time at contemporary art performances, and the audience members would get so angry because they were being manipulated by performers, to the point of, like, actually being emotionally manipulated, but also being picked up and having their chair taken away from them. And it was the same feeling of, like, this is my space where the rules which I believe in apply, and you are breaking those rules and you don't care about me. And so that is also the substance of Žižek's philosophy. So he's doing it, he's also writing it, right? And sometimes it's philosophically extremely strong, and sometimes it's just regurgitated shit, right? So again, like, the politics of it are bright, right? Like, there's a kind of aggressiveness to the way in which he is affecting people, and that becomes read politically not by accident, right? The issue then, it seems like, is how does that affect a social world which is gone awry somehow, right? Do we all need to be more polite in order and considerate and stronger scholars and know the difference between facts and non-facts in order to produce a good social world, right? And what he's saying is no. And you can disagree with that, but that's what he's saying, right? He's saying there's another way to go about it because that's a normative imposition. And from his point of view, that's also creepy, right? It's also creepy to believe that. And so, like many Slovene contemporary art projects and performers, he puts himself in the position where you heap the anger on him. But that anger is a social anger. That anger is much bigger than him, right? And he brings it out, he makes it articulate, and it goes on to him. This is not the cappy. He's not a good person, right? He's not a good person.
In the age of Trump and Erdogan and all these things, I mean, we have people like that who are wielding incredible power.
Right.
Yeah. You know, so for me, this has lost a bit of its playful innocence, you know.
A bit.
That's all.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, actually, this would have been exactly my question. So thanks a lot. Very intriguing, also dangerous. What is the difference between Zizek and Trump?
Yeah.
So is it the intentionality behind it? Because what you keep saying is, or you keep repeating that he knows about this. He does this for a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
Trump
also sometimes appears as a clownesque performer that demonstrates to us the absurdity of the U.S. political system and current social processes, etc.
Right.
So what is the difference between the two in terms of them being engaged in bullshit?
That's a great question, because I would say that it's probably self-awareness.
Zizek is more dangerous.
I don't think he has a lot less power, but the... Zizek has a political project, which is about making people angry, maybe. And Trump, I don't think, has that political project. So the bullshitter, I mean, Franklin's book doesn't use the word Trump ever, but that's what the whole book is about, right?
So it turns out that Donald Trump is aware of what he's doing. Would call him an artist?
Well, he has been called an artist. You know this? There's this whole thing about how Donald Trump is this great piece of performance art that Banksy made, right? And that it's like gotten completely lost. He's lost control of his art, right? So, and that they say the border wall is essentially like a giant piece of installation art. So you can read it that way. But he is, in fact, a politician with, a lot of power to the degree that people follow him. I don't think Zizek is simply not in the same structural position as that, and he has a different project. And that project is still political, maybe more political, actually, than Trump's project is.
So I just want to quickly add to this, because now we've come a full circle. Before we were saying that this is common critique of art that I was making. So if you
Very
call them,
critique of art,
yeah, if you call them artists like Trump and all these, then I'm making critique of that kind of art, not the other one. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm not calling them artists, but.
Yes, sorry. One, two.
Thank you very much. I have a horrible feeling my question is pretty much the same. Maybe it's like we're in this sort of self-performing bubble or something. But I kind of want to ask it a little bit differently, which is, in the face of the So if you analyze it in terms of subjectivity and so on, that's a very different kind of angle from if you analyze it, I suppose, as the politics of conning people.
Right.
And I think that kind of goes to what Gabby is asking, mm-hmm. that seems quite absent
mm-hmm.
in there.
Yeah.
What's the consequence and effect of that? And the other bit that I just found listening to you, I was really, really enjoying a lot of it, but I had a massive kind of sort of discomfort with some issues around gender mm-hmm. and how that mm-hmm. plays into it. And I wondered if you might comment on that as well there.
Do you think that he is conning people?
I guess what I think is that, if you're asking me, is
yeah.
the discomfort of somebody like Zizek, I don't know that it's about their self and subjectivity. I mean, you gave a convincing case, but to me, the kind of central thing is that people think, wait, is there something in it? Isn't there? Are
right.
we being conned or not?
Yeah.
And that, trying to figure that out, is what engenders these, on the one hand, people think, yes, but he's really clever, we know, somehow. And on the other, actually, maybe we're all being tricked by mm-hmm. the games, and that's where the discourse of the charlatan and all of that comes from. So that would be my,
Yeah, so that's great. So the, thank you for clarifying. The thing, the procedure that I think he and many of the other projects of people that I analyze as a part of this larger project, the thing that is most remarkable is that both of those questions are held open. So, is there something in there or not? Is he for real or not? Is he a philosopher or a bullshitter? Is he this? It's this constant, and that's what I said, that it's the balancing act that is actually remarkable, right? It's the, he is a bullshitter, he is a philosopher, he is a philosopher and a bullshitter at the same time. He is X, he is not X, and he is X and not X simultaneously to each other. So collapsing him to talk about the politics of conning people collapses it into one of those things. And you can do that. He leaves it open for that to happen, right? But there's always this temptation to bring it back to a question. Real, not real. Real, not real. Real, not real. For real, not for real. Dangerous, playful. Performance, philosophy. And it's that I think is actually what's powerful about what he's doing. Gender. That picture is so weird that I showed you, right? And it's a very famous old painting called The Origins of the World, old meaning 1800s. Which doesn't, which on its own is very generous and romantic and erotic and doing all kinds of stuff. And he has put it there between his own legs, right? And this is, again, a maneuver. And in this case, I think a visual maneuver to say, what's in his pants? What's there? What do we see? What's there? What do we see? What's there? To get to produce this toggle back and forth and back and forth. So that gender is just a tool in this case for keeping one off balance, keeping the viewer off balance, the participant off balance. And I think the people that he is least interested in are the ones who believe in him. I went to a Laibach show, for those of you who don't know, it's a Slovene kind of punk, rock, noise, pop band who was very famous for a time. None of my students know who they are anymore. But I went to a Laibach show and they're sort of fake white supremacist neo-Nazis, right? And the in the front row of this show were all of these real believers for a greater Slovenia, like real skinheads with a map of the greater Slovenia on flags, you know, waving it back and forth. And at some point in the show, they just said, we will not succumb to your demands, and they pointed at these guys, right? It's the same set of procedures. It's the same thing of, you can take us for what you want us to be. You can see in us what you want to see, but that is not who we necessarily are. What we are is something open, that toggle, right? Again, white supremacists, not. Nazis, fascists, not. Austrians, not.
Thank you very much for the talk. My question is, my reaction rather, is that I'm a little bit surprised that what does not come out from your talk at all, and I think this determinative of all the things we've said here, is how much all this, what Zizek in a very, very large respect Nacht's, the Lacanian theory, and there is a theory of subjectivity behind, mm-hmm. a theory authorizing for reasons that you may share or not share, but authorizing to treat other people or other people's reasoning as shit, etc., and Zizek notes it. The painting, which you just evoked, is L'origine du monde, which was on Lacan's mm-hmm. office, you know, and it comes out in the writing, it comes out in the behavior. This is a little bit surprised because the topic doesn't come out at all.
No, because I don't treat Zizek in my work as a, I treat him as a local. I don't treat him as a philosopher.
As a local?
Like just as somebody in Slovenia, and the way I would treat any person essentially in Slovenia. I use the Lacanian philosophy. When I go to Lacan, I talk a lot. I use Ladan Dolorès's work mostly. So I treat him more as a philosopher. And the reason I do that very intentionally, because when I first started doing this work, whenever I talked about anything that had anything to do with Slovenia, people would say, well, you know, Zizek writes about this, and here's what he says. Right? And at some point, I was like, of course he's the best informant about everything that's happening in this place. But he's also a Slovene. And I think it's very important to take him seriously as a person. So as a philosopher, but not his philosophy. So it's not that I don't know that stuff. I know it back and forth and inside and out, right? But in this case, and I make this argument at the very beginning of the book for why I've made these decisions. So I talk about where analytic purchase is coming from. In the story. So,
fully.
Yeah.
But then there's a question of someone who has had a large part of his training in France, who's mm-hmm. been heard never in France but in the States, and then who comes back in Slovenia. So this you cannot also talk to
him. What do you mean he's never been heard in France?
He's not, in France he went away because he had very bad relations, you know, so everybody mm-hmm. rejected him. So, and he's never the audience he got in the States and then from the rest of the world, he never got it in France. That way. So
he doesn't really get it in Slovenia either.
Sorry?
He doesn't get it in Slovenia either. He's quite dismissed. I think this was a good example, actually, that early on in this black and white phase, he was he came up at a certain point in time when his philosophy had a lot of power for a grassroots movement. Toward, I'm not sure you would say independence, but something else, right? Something else than what was there in the 1980s. But he's not the philosopher who's taken most seriously or even very seriously in Slovenia for his work. He does do some good philosophical work. He does a lot of crap, but he does do some good work too. And so part of my decision was to take the philosophers who were taken seriously within Slovenia and use their analysis in the book, and to let him be a figure in some way. Like I have some artists who are also essentially figures in the story.
Thank you.
sorry, put myself on this.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Thanks very much. I heard your talk mainly as a, and I thought it worked brilliantly like that, as a critique of the pervasiveness of the depth subjectivity model, which we just confronted here in a very particular way. What I was wondering, and I thought there was a US, there was a North Americanness to it, but now the response by the audience lets me think maybe not. but my question was slightly different in the sense, is do we not need to bring sociality into it? Is there a model of subjectivity which is somehow detached from forms of sociality because it just sort of responded to discourse as an individualized act?
Mm-hmm.
So my question would be, what kind of sociality does bullshit
mm-hmm.
require, perform, and afford? And does that link us back to the earlier critique of the kind of the political nature of this? So what forms of sociality are implied or whatever. That would be one.
Mm-hmm.
The other one, which I'm lacking still, and of course there's no, probably no simple answer to this, but I think you characterize this figure in this ambivalence very well, and there is Trump, and you could have all kinds of political elites these days. If we now understand, if we understand this the way you do it, what did we then do with it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I still don't know, I'm screaming bullshit at the television, but it doesn't help.
Right.
Because you're saying it's right, it is bullshit.
It is bullshit.
But it doesn't make it go away.
Right.
It doesn't make me calm down. I get very stressed. And, you know, this becomes almost like a state of everyday life because you can scream at the television and lots of people every single day. How do we deal with this?
So I think this is a really great question. The paper really is a critique of subjectivity, and the point of the paper, Zizek being such a spectacular figure kind of to the side, the point of the paper is there are other ways to do subjectivity, and that these are disturbing. So then to take it to the, so I'm happy you got that. To take it to the question of sociality, I think different things as an ethnographer and as a human being about this, if these things can be divided. I think as an ethnographer, there's something about Zizek that creates conversation. Regardless of the content of that conversation, he produces conversations, often among strangers, about things which are intimate. And I've seen that happen again and again, and I find it kind of amazing. It's like when you have a giant splat, like you throw a stone into the water. It's not the rings from the stone, it's the splash that the little water droplets make out, you know, and all of these little rings that just disappear at some point. But he does that. So as a person, I think there is something so cruel about this idea that one should be a totally flexible master of one's own subjectivity and be able to sort of change it in order to suit the circumstances and be whoever needs to be whoever you need to be, and kind of this like flexible, constantly transformative, well-known, total mastery of the self that here Cornel West is standing in for, but which you see just again and again and again, that I feel like there's so much more pain in trying to realize that model than the just being like angry at a politician, right? And that's where you get biopolitics, for example, where it is not this sort of aggressive emotional moment of like, what do I do? How do I fix it? But it is this like total acceptance and imbrication in creating a world in which that is how people have to be in order to get by. So my critique is largely of that form of subjectivity that is gestured at in this paper, and to say, like, there are options. I don't think we need to all be Zizek. I hope not. It'd be really not so much fun. And I think especially the kind of passion for hierarchy, for being the center of attention that he has and the other bullshitters have is something that it's nice to step away from. That's something I would say I find really painful. But how you change a bullshitter, I don't know, right? And the fear, of course, that Franklin has about politicians who are bullshitters, or politics which is based on bullshit, is that the masses will simply follow that, right? And I don't see the masses simply following Zizek. I see them calling him, calling his shit, basically. So I wish I had an answer. Do you have an answer?
No, that's why I get more and more angry. And I don't think that's very helpful or healthy.
Yeah.
I become cynical, which is no good either.
Mm. Well, yeah.
So, there's a last, yes.
Okay, one short question. Mm-hmm. Methodology. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're talking about subjectivity. You use Zizek as a local. The big question for me is, like, did you actually talk to him?
So that's a great.
And that's a great question, right? Does that matter to you?
Yeah.
I mean, does the question of, like, fieldwork relationships and, like, kind of, like, what does it mean then, ethnography?
Right. So the I did not ever talk to Zizek, except for this one interaction, because he wasn't in Slovenia when I was there. I did talk to a lot of people, and they're everywhere else, all over the book. So, but I think that voice, we have voice beyond this moment, and I was in Slovenia. I was there for 3 years, I'm okay with using media, and the reason that I have this moment when I'm there watching him do his thing is because that's a big part. I mean, that's participant observation, right? Right there. There I was. And I don't have to sit down and have a conversation with him to have a pretty strong feeling about what he's doing and how it fits into this wider picture. But I would certainly not only do that, right? I've had really the good fortune, I think, of seeing some of these, especially the artists, go on in their lives and meet them at particular points and within different projects that they're doing, and be able to kind of tie those conversations and personas and projects into stories. So of the book, in the book, this chapter and the afterword are the only two pieces where I am there, but I'm not in this, like, you know, I'm not living on his couch. Thank God. Also, one last thing is that a lot of what matters in Slovenia is how one closes doors and delimits relationships. So and Zizek also writes about this, but the... So there is something to the way in which one doesn't have access to people in a way that makes anthropologists comfortable, that's also a form of data, right? So he's also doing that. He's also creating a space across which it's very difficult to step.
Thanks very much. We've reached the end of our time. I hope it made you think, or angry, or both. We enjoyed it anyway. Two things left. First of all, thank you very much for being here. Thank you very much for this great presentation. We'll continue the discussion. Second point is over to Jens for organizing next week's session.
Yes. Next week's session is the last session in this year. I would like to invite you to get to know the work of Martina von Schnitzler that we have as our guest. Next week, Antina works as an anthropologist at the New School in New York. Her ethnographic work is based in South Africa, where she is mostly interested in infrastructures and in water infrastructures, in the access to water, of people living in townships in South Africa. And what she does very well, from my point of view, is to show how the political status and the political narratives and the political struggles connected to actual water change over this transformation, the political transformation from an apartheid state to a neoliberal statehood. And on a conceptual level, what we can learn from her is how to take infrastructure as a starting point for ethnographic work interested in the political. So, please come again next week to listen to Tina Schnitzler. And thanks again
for this
wonderful.